welcome to the Truly Amazing Women Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. In each episode of the show, we shine a spotlight on the women who are making strides and changing lives. Hello, and welcome to the Truly Amazing Women Show and the Grateful American Radio Show. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, your host. We are here today with Dr. Catherine Algor, a professor of history at the University of California and a Yale PhD. She is now the director of education at the Huntington Library Art Collection and Botanical Gardens. Her 2006 book, A Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation, was a finalist for the George Washington Prize in 2007. Her book was then turned into the script for the American Experience film for PBS entitled Dolly Madison, America's First Lady. So welcome to the show, Catherine. We are thrilled to have you here.
Hi, Hope. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Oh, well, it's really an honor and a pleasure. Before we launch into our Q&A, I want to tell the audience a little bit about your career. Catherine Algor actually began her career as an actress, and she worked in the theater for about 10 years before attending Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts, as a Francis Perkins Scholar. She graduated summa cum laude in history, and not long after went on to study at Yale University, where she received her PhD, and also won the Yale Teaching Award. Her dissertation on women and politics in early Washington garnered the George Washington Eagleston Prize for the best dissertation in American history at Yale University, and the Lerner Scott Prize for the best dissertation in U.S. women's history in the country. Professor Algor's next book, Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington helped build a city and a government, won the James H. Bussard First Book Prize for the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic. Then, in 2002 to 2004, she became a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and was a visiting professor of history at Harvard. She actually began her teaching career at Simmons College, a college for women in Boston, and she currently holds both a professorship at the University of California at Riverside and most recently was appointed to the post of Director of Education at the Huntington Library Art Collections and Botanical Gardens, also in California. Catherine was awarded the University of California Presidential Chair, and she has written several books. The first, which we'll be talking about at length today, is A Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation, which was a finalist for the Washington Book Prize in 2007. That book went on to become an American Experience film called Dolly Madison, and was actually one of the first biographies by the American Experience to feature a woman. Most recently, the University of Virginia Press published her book, The Queen of America, Mary Cutts' Life of Dolly Madison, which explores the memoir that Mary Cutts wrote about her famous aunt. Last but certainly not least, Al Gore was recently nominated by President Obama to serve on the James Madison Memorial Fellowship Foundation. So holy moly, Catherine, what a career. We are so thrilled to have you here. Now let's jump into our Q&A. First, how did you get involved and interested in studying the life of Dolly Madison?
Hope, it all started when I was in graduate school with my dissertation. I was interested in a question, which was, were women political in the United States before they had the right to vote? So we all know the story of suffrage, but, you know, is there a way for women to be political without having real political power? And I decided probably the place to find that would be Washington, D.C. in the early 1800s when it was becoming a capital. And I also knew from some previous research I had done on Louisa Catherine Johnson Adams, who was the wife and political partner of John Quincy Adams, that probably if women had political influence, it probably happened in the realm of society, right? So they can't be elected, they can't hold office, but they do have these social events. That was all I had, Hope. That was it. That was my hunch. And so the first thing I did, as many a researcher will do, is I talked to wonderful librarians and archivists, and I would say, I'm interested in women and political power in the early 1800s and society. And they would invariably say, oh, I don't think we have anything. Which isn't, by the way, an uncommon response to questions about women's history. Their first thought was, no, we don't have anything. But inevitably, there would be a pause, and they'd say, well, there's always Dolly Madison. So I knew Dolly Madison because I'd grown up in Philadelphia where we have Dolly Madison ice cream. And I had watched those Charlie Brown specials with Dolly Madison Cakes and Pies. So I always had her on my mind. Now, when I actually went to these librarians, or these libraries and the archives, of course I found a lot of things. Women's stories, voices, their papers are often hidden under designations like personal papers, or sometimes hidden under men's names. And as it turns out, researching this book, which became Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington helped build a city and a government, that's its full title, I uncovered lots of stories of women doing politics using social events. But always, in the back of my mind, was Dolly Madison. So I was about halfway through the dissertation that became the book, and I thought, well, I had this little placeholder chapter called This Will Be the Dolly Madison Chapter, and I thought, I'm just going to knock this out, right? This is going to be easier than a lot of things because there's a lot published about her. Let me just knock this out. But, of course, I don't need to tell you that I became quite interested in her, mostly because she was perfect. She was the epitome of everything I was trying to say about how women worked politically, how their culture regarded them, the pitfalls of women's political work. It was all there in the life of Dolly Madison. But what I did discover, which shocked me, was that there was not a scholarly treatment of her life. So there's a lot of books about Dolly. I hope I meet women of all ages who tell me they read a biography of Dolly Madison as a child. A lot of children's books and a lot of novels and a lot of, you know, popular history. But no one except Holly Shulman, who is the editor of Dolly's papers at the University of Virginia, had ever treated Dolly as a serious historical figure. So after Parlor Politics, to answer your question, I just couldn't let it go, and I knew my next project had to be a real biography of Dolly Madison.
That's wonderful. You did an amazing job. Kat Imhoff, who is our cover story for the July issue of my business magazine, Be Incandescent, she highly recommended it, and I'm so glad she did. And then I went ahead and watched the PBS special, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But tell me, tell our listeners, what intrigues you most about Dolly Madison?
That she was famous. I thought that was very interesting. You know, I sort of, it sounds like a joke when I tell you about the Dolly Madison cakes and pies, but there's something really significant there because this is an era where women aren't famous. So, in fact, the sign of a proper woman is that she's not famous, that she's never mentioned in newspapers. During the early 1800s, this isn't a time where women are mentioned at all in newspapers, but Dolly was famous. And she was arguably more famous than her husband during the sort of presidency, so I can call her maybe the most famous American in the world. Everybody talked about her. And then at some point in the mid-19th century, she becomes an advertising icon. So after her death, she is on everything. So she's on dolls, china, hairpins, anything to do with women's goods or sociability or Americanness. She becomes an icon for the Republican Party in the late 19th century, into the 20th century. And I wondered, like, why this woman? But of course, for the advertisers, it was because she was famous during her life. And so I thought, well, there's got to be some really complicated answer to why she was so famous. But of course, it's an easy answer. She was famous because she wielded a great deal of political power. She was famous for exactly the same reason as her male counterparts were famous. She was politically powerful. But because we sort of can't really deal with a powerful political woman, especially in the 1800s, the fame kind of gets transmuted or covered, and so then she becomes this advertising icon, sort of piggybacking off of a fame that seems to be about her being a really nice person and giving a lot of lovely parties. But the truth is, it was because it was grounded in her political power.
And she was truly just a genius when it came to making peace and being a diplomat. And she also had a fascinating style that other women were intrigued by. She was a little bit on the cutting edge. She had a big bosom, and that attracted a lot of attention. So tell us a little bit actually about their lives and their marriage. They were an unlikely couple. He was scholarly and sort of tiny, and she was vivacious and quite beautiful. She had been widowed and when they met. So tell us a little bit more about her for people that don't know the backstory.
Well, Dolly Madison had been born in the world of the Virginia gentry, and she and her parents, she was actually born in North Carolina, and she always said, I'm really, you know, born in North Carolina, but I'm really a Virginian. Her family, though, were very different from other Virginians in that they were Quakers, and that's how they ended up in North Carolina. So they're a Virginia family. They go out for about a year to what was then the frontier of America, which is North Carolina, to be in a Quaker community, and then they come back pretty quickly. So we're not exactly sure what happened in North Carolina, but given what we know of Dolly's father, probably some shady business practices. But she grows up in the world of the Virginia gentry, the countryside. Her family have some slaves. It's not a big plantation, but she grows up with enslaved African Americans. And then right around 15, so she's almost a woman, but still like an adolescent, her father and the Quakers sort of decide that holding slaves is incompatible with Quaker practices. And so her father lets the slaves go. Well, they can't stay in Virginia. You need slaves. So they go off, and I find this so interesting. They don't even go to, like, a southern city, which would have been less of a culture shock, but her father moves them to Philadelphia, which was downright chilly for a southerner, but it is the seat of American Quakerisms. And, in fact, her father is not a born Quaker. He converts when he marries Dolly's mother. He's a little bit like that old joke about the convert. He's much more zealous than an actual, quote-unquote, born Quaker. And I won't tell you all the things, but I'll say that between the age of 15 to 25, things do not go well for Dolly Payne. That was her natal name. She loses all of her brothers. They die. Her father dies at some point after he's disgraced by the Quakers and kicked out and suffers in business. She loses a little sister. She marries a man named John Todd, who is not a man apparently for choosing, but they seem to have made a happy life together. She gives birth to a son. She gives birth to another son. And then in 1793, there's a terrible yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia, and people just die. And in this epidemic, Dolly loses her new husband, her fairly new husband, and her brand new baby, and her in-laws, and it devastates the city. And so she's 25, going on 26, when she meets James Madison, but all these terrible things have happened to her. And people make a lot of the idea that there's a big contrast between these two people, and you're absolutely right, Hope. There is a lot of contrast. James Madison is an intellectual. He's sort of tiny and sickly looking, and she's this beautiful, tall, curvaceous woman, very vital, and people make much of that. But the truth is they were very similar in very important ways, which I think you see in your own life when you look at a couple and you think they're so different, but there's always something that draws them together. And I call it unity, which is a desire. These are not people who like confrontation. They don't like hostility. They value harmony and unity. So even though they look very different, and they're very complementary, too, to each other, they also have these deep commonalities. One of the mysteries I sort of talk about in the book, too, is we wonder, though, why she marries James Madison. She's going to do it quickly. So she marries James Madison less than a year after her first husband dies. That's a little speedy. It's a little speedy for the Quakers, in fact. They think she gets in trouble with the Quakers because of that. And the record is that he's the first person to ask her. So why him, in a way? I don't know that she was particularly attracted by his intellect. And, you know, yes, he was a rich man, but, you know, she was – had a little income of her own, and she could have waited for somebody more, say, sexually charismatic or, you know, younger, because James Madison was about 15 years older than she was. Actually, I think more than that. I'm sorry, a little bit older than that. Why James? And my theory is that because James could offer her something that few men could, and that is a return to the world of the Virginia gentry. So we have no records on this. We only have one letter from her talking about this, and she talks about her choice of James as a good guardian for her now little son that she has left. But I think that James offered her a way to go back to the world of childhood. If you think about all the trauma she saw between 15 and 25, surely she remembered her Virginia childhood as a kind of golden time, and that's what James Madison had to offer her.
That's fascinating. Talk a little bit, I mean, there's so many nuances and experiences that we could talk about, but what struck me most, especially from the film, was the end of her life and how sad she seemed and how distraught. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I would say that one of the sad things about Dolly Madison was she never really quite had a home. So she, as I've said, her early life was kind of disruptive. She goes, when she marries James, she gets to go back to Montpelier, and if you've ever been there, what a beautiful setting that is, what a gorgeous house. But when she came back as a young bride, James Madison's mother, Nellie Conway Madison, was quite old, but she was fully in charge of that house. And I always say that Dolly really found her home in 1801 when she was in her 30s. When she became, when she was the wife of the Secretary of State, she came to Washington. In some ways, that was Dolly's home. So for 16 years, first as the wife of the Secretary of State, and then as, of course, First Lady, she presided over Washington. And she was loved. She was also, you know, feared and hated, which proves her political power, by the way, Hope, when people hate and fear you. But she was, you know, loved. She presided. She had a grand time. Then they retire, and they leave in a cloud of glory, and then she goes back to Montpelier. And those years, she's lonely. She's with James, and James shares James. She and James love each other very much in their marriage. But it's quiet. James, of course, now is, you know, he's older, so he is perfectly happy to stay at home. And she practically never leaves Montpelier in the 20 years between their retirement and James's death. And it's a very quiet country life, and she misses Washington, and she wants. And she writes to her nieces and says, "Tell me everything." When James dies, it's a terrible blow to her. She's crushed by grief. But as soon as she can, she gets the heck out of Orange and she heads back to Washington. And so her attachment really is to Washington D.C. The problem really is that there's several problems going on, but the problem really is that her little that little son, that little boy who survived yellow fever with her, grows into one of the most dissolute young men you can imagine, spoiled, privileged, entitled, and he gambled, drank, and who knows what, all up and down the eastern seaboard. At one point, he's tossed into the jail for debt. And he just sucks the funds out of James and Dolly Madison. So in the end, she's impoverished because she's not a very good parent. There was no one to tell, we call him Payne Todd, for that actually is what he was called, but it's also Payne is a great nickname for him. Nobody told Payne Todd no, and she was an indulgent mother, and James Madison was an indulgent stepfather, and they just bankrupted themselves. And in the end, she loses Montpelier. So I think it's by 1844, Montpelier, she's now in Washington full-time because she's had to sell Montpelier. So it's very sad, this story, where she ends up in poverty. But it really is of her own doing. And I find that that's an interesting pattern, I think. I wonder if you would agree with me about often there are public figures, and I think of like the Roosevelts, who are terrific as public figures, but they're not necessarily the best parents. And Dolly was not a great parent, and she kind of paid for it. Though I have to say, if you have to live in poverty, do it in Washington, D.C. She was such an icon during that time that, and people, you know, they just loved her. She got invited out to a lot of places. And one of the theories Holly Shulman and I have about why she has such a hectic social calendar is that she needs to go to places to eat, that she needs to go to these parties so she gets a little food. And part of her poverty, as we note, I think, in the film, is that she doesn't have a lot of money to spend on new clothes, which she totally would, Hope. If she had had the money, she would have spent it. But she ends up wearing kind of her old clothes. But that really contributes to her status as an icon. So in some ways, and those are the photographs, if you can believe we have photographs of her. She's always in these sober black dresses with these shawls from her youth. So even in 1846, 47, 48, she seems to echo the early days of the Republic. So she does live in poverty at the end, but she's also revered and loved. So I think there's a compensation there.
That's excellent. So let's talk. There's so many things to talk to you about. I want to talk about the PBS special, but I also want to talk again about The Perfect Union, which the special is based on, the film. And in it, you start off with talking about Dolly Madison staving the portrait of George Washington. And in fact, the New York Times, when they reviewed your book, they talked about how wonderful that was that you started there, that it was the perfect beginning. So tell us a little bit about that actual event and then segue into talking about how the film came to be.
Well, that event is, I mean, it was kind of very nice of them to say that, but it was a very natural way to start the book because it's the thing she's most famous for. And what's interesting, though, is it's not exactly clear how true that event is or how it's colored, and I'll tell you why. But I have to also say to your listeners, especially if there's any listeners in the Washington, D.C. area, we're having a conference in September about, it's Mr. Madison's War, it's about the War of 1812, and Holly Shulman and I are presenting a pair of papers about this moment, which is that as the British are descending upon Washington and Dolly Madison is alone in the White House, meaning alone with her servants and slaves, she's basically trying to wait to see if James Madison will come and tell her what to do. But at some point, she's got to go. But this cements her historical legacy is through these days she's been sending out papers. She doesn't save the Declaration of Independence, but she does save the notes in the Constitutional Convention and all kinds of silver and paper she's sending and all these things out in anticipation that the British are going to come and burn the city, which there's every expectation. Also, there are threats against her. So Admiral Colburn, who's going to come in and indeed raise the city and burn the White House, threatens her, not her husband. So she's in danger of being taken prisoner. The greatest danger would be to be killed, of course, but also be to taken prisoner and sent back to London. So she's in definite danger. She waits as long as possible. And then she goes. But before she goes, she instructs her servants and her slave. Paul Jennings is the slave, and a man they call French John Suissant is her servant. And they take the portrait down, and they take it out of the frame, so it's on its stretcher. It's not rolled up or cut. It's on a stretcher. And she gives it to two men who put it on a cart and take it outside the city. And this is probably what happened. That's probably true. But we don't really actually have a contemporary 1814, this is, right, August 1814, account of it. What we have is in the 1830s, so 20 years after all this is happening, a journalist, a writer named Margaret Baird Smith wants to work with Dolly on a little biographical sketch of Dolly. And Dolly's very flattered by this, but also nervous, and she doesn't know if she has anything important to say, and she alludes to a letter. She says, "You must get this letter because this letter will tell you about those days in Washington and what I did." And we hear about the letter, but we never really see that letter. What we have, I hope this is all we have, is an account, a very famous account, which you remember, I'm sure people know about, of the last day of the White House. But it was undoubtedly written in 1844, so 30 years. And the idea is that it's supposed to be a fair copy, that is a copy of a letter. But we don't have the original. And it's not unthought of that somehow Dolly is shaping what undoubtedly happened for an eye to her own historical legacy. Is that subtle enough?
Makes perfect sense. It's a great story.
So it's an interesting story about our history, but it's also a story about history. You know, by 1844, Dolly's been working on her husband's papers. So she and James have been working since the 1820s on putting his papers together. And they edit them, they admit this is a different time, right? They don't have the same standards we do. They sort of edit them. So it's natural for her to be thinking about her historical legacy. So when Margaret Baird Smith asks for this letter that Dolly apparently can't find, the fact that she would kind of sort of write it from memory, as it were, is not an odd thing. So, she undoubtedly did save the portrait. It's not that she was lying, but it's about sort of shaping history because that letter has gone down in history. It's a great letter. It's about, you feel the immediacy of her waiting for James and then having to flee. It's a great letter, but it may not have exactly been written at the time.
Gotcha. That's great. I also love the part of that story where she was waiting for him and had all this grand feast set out with wine and beer and whatnot, and that the British came in and they ate it all up. Because they had fled.
And that dinner used to puzzle people. They were sort of like, what is, why is she putting up this dinner? She's fiddling when Rome burns. But the truth is that dinner was actually, the whole incident of how she handled that last few days of the White House is her career in microcosm. She had always used social events to bring people together and to convey images and feelings of legitimacy and authority and reassurance. Remember, right before the invasion, there's all these rumors of invasion, but there always have been rumors of invasion. So part of the reason that dinner was going to happen was she was going to invite all these locals, like, don't worry, we've got it under control, everything's fine. Of course, this time the rumors were true and they weren't fine, but that's what that dinner was about. It was going to be bringing all these people in, even as James Madison is riding out to the field to look at the troops. She was going to reassure everybody that everything was okay. So that was the story of that dinner.
Yeah, so fascinating. I mean, the reflection of what this meant of her and for the country moving forward. Because she, in the PBS film, you talk about, and in your book, of course, you talk about how she really kept D.C. as the capital. She lobbied, and even when Congress was thinking maybe of moving it to Philadelphia after D.C. was burnt that year.
It's funny, too, when you look at Dolley's work, really starting in 1801 when she's the wife of the Secretary of State. She's embarking on political work. It's really for her husband. But, of course, like all kinds of things, it has consequences. And then the War of 1812 comes, and suddenly everything she's done, the stakes get higher. So, and one of the things she did was she really made Washington City a capital city. So we all know about Washington, D.C. It was not built on a swamp, let me just say that right now, but it was pretty hot. It was an invented town. It was invented for politics. And lots of people thought it was a terrible place for a capital city. They would have much rather been in New York or Philadelphia, which were at that point real cities with cultural stuff and financial stuff. But Washington was just a town built on politics. So, you know, at any point, the reason there was this call for, they called it removal after the city was burned, was because there had been a call for removal. People wanted. So Dolley, though, comes in and creates all the social networks and all the political networks and all the centers of attraction. And they become, I think, indispensable to politics. And so the people that voted against removal, I think, were very practical. They said, well, you know, here we've built these networks at her social events, especially at her drawing rooms. Why should we leave all of those, that great sort of little political machine that she's building, and go to Philadelphia or New York, where not only would we have to start all over, but it's a more complicated city. There are cultural elites and social elites and political elites. She had made Washington such a good rudimentary political machine that I think that was part of what led people to say, let's keep the capital here. Now, did she plan that? No. It was sort of a consequence of her work. And, of course, she could not have known at all at some point that this city was going to be burned. But it's interesting how the different functions I talk about, her becoming a charismatic figure for her husband, her developing the role of what we would call first lady, all of these things she did ended up really sort of paying off in the moment of crisis.
So along those lines, let's talk about how that PBS special came to be. It's based on your book, is that right?
Yeah, I would have to say that is true. It came about because, and I think it's part of what we're talking about here, we're talking about me, we're talking about Dolley Madison. We're also talking about, I think, the enterprise of women's history. And I think that's an important sort of subtext to understand this. So it started in the 90s. There's a wonderful group called Middlemarch Films, Muffy Meyer and Ron Bloomer, and they have made many historical documentaries, Alexander Hamilton and the Liberty series. I think they were involved even in that very famous documentary, Grey Gardens. So these are people who have vast experience of historical documentaries. And one of the people they use as their kind of experts is a historian named Carol Birkin. And Carol's actually a women's historian. She was she's now retired. I'm sorry, I'm sort of blanking on where she was. Brewer College, I'm sorry, in New York. But she also is an expert on the Constitution and the founders and the things like that. So they would call on Carol, and Carol would talk about Hamilton or Jefferson or whatever. But at one point they said to her, you know, we'd love to do a story of women's history, but we don't know any. The only story they knew was suffrage, right? So 1848, Seneca Falls, the fight for the vote. Great story, by the way. But it's kind of surprising that these very sophisticated, educated filmmakers didn't know stories of women's history because there's a ton of them. But of course, they're just reflecting their larger culture. So Carol Burkin said, well, there's this woman writing this book called Parlor Politics, and have you ever thought about Dolly Madison? So they read a little on Dolly, and of course they were immediately intrigued, as you know we all were. But remember, I hadn't written the scholarly biography. So they brought me in probably in the early 2000s, and along with Holly Shulman, and they said, let's talk about what we would make this story about. And Holly and I were just really starting our work on Dolly Madison, and we couldn't really talk about her historical significance in a way, because we hadn't really done the work. So it was very frustrating in the early 2000s. We sort of, you know, we sort of knew she was important, but we didn't know exactly how to talk about it. And I remember at the time they were like, we have a choice. It's going to be either Dolly Madison or Alexander Hamilton. And I'm like, well, come on, a guy with a gun. Do we need yet another story of a guy with a gun? You know, can't we have a woman with a war? So they were interested, they were encouraging, but we couldn't quite get our arms around what Dolly Madison meant. So they said to me, basically, go away. This is about maybe 2002. Go away and write the book and then come back. Because we had to figure out what we were going to say. And that's really how it happened. It stayed on the back burner. I think they did make Alexander Hamilton. It was fabulous. And then around 2006, when the book was about to come out, they're like, okay, let's get back in here and tell us what you found out, so that I could talk about her role in developing the First Lady. I could talk about her lasting historical significance. And so they sort of said, let's start doing this. But making the film was very interesting because there was a lot of nervousness. This is where you make a film and then American Experience basically buys it. A lot of nervousness about making a film about a woman, and hard to raise money. And it took years and years. And in fact, Land O'Lakes, I love this because of the whole, you know, sort of dessert connection. Finally, it was like the last $100,000 or something with Land O'Lakes. They had to raise the money basically through private means because nobody was certain about making this kind of serious documentary about a woman. And you've said to me, Hope, off the air, you've said nice things about it, and I'm very proud of the documentary. But it is, it's got some problems to it. So here's one of them, and I hope you'll be amused and by this. At some point, the people, I think probably in American Experience, got nervous because there wasn't enough about a war in the story that we were telling. Dolly's has a major role in Washington during the War of 1812, but she's not on the battlefield. And, of course, we all know that history means war so much in the popular mind. So even though you're very complimentary about the film, and I'm very proud of it, there is a moment, my dear, where we lose Dolly and we suddenly have CGI ships sailing. And instead of telling the story of what Dolly did in the war, they told the story of the war a little bit. And that's one of those compromises you make trying to get your film done, to reassure them that this was real history, so there's a war in it. But the upshot is the film came out. I was so pleased. It was such a labor of love to make it. It got reviewed in a very serious historical journal by a colleague of mine, and she ripped into it. She pointed out all the problems and all the things that were concerning about it. And afterwards I saw her and she said, oh, I'm so sorry, I had to be really critical about it. And I said, I'm fine with it. I said, if you knew what it took to get that made, you have to understand that I'm just so thrilled that it was made, that even if it did have like these moments where we suddenly are talking about the war instead of Dolly, I don't care. I'm just so happy that it was made. And I have to tell you too, Hope, that people have loved it. It was one of the higher, you know, ratings, American Experience. So it was a complete success as far as I'm concerned. But if you go and you look at something like American Experience or any of the sort of documentary shows, you'll see how very few of them have an actual single woman as its subject. So making it was a real exercise for me in, you know, the mission that we have as women's historians, part of which is to get the stories of women out to the public.
It's just shocking. I think that film came out in 2010. That was like yesterday. And is it really that hard? It's just amazing. I mean, I saw the piece on Alexander Hamilton, which was terrific. But I'm just shocked. So we're going to have to take that on as a mission to get more historic women into all kinds of different media. So that leads us to tell us about yourself, because you're obviously on the cutting edge of so many things.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Well, you know, you're very kind to have contacted me about this project and very kind to think of me as a truly amazing woman. But I thought about what I would like to tell your audience about. If anything in my life is in any way, you know, could prompt a kind of insight for someone else. And I really think it's the story of transitions, transitions that happen because of one's own personal growth, because of external circumstances, but also about being a woman. So as you mentioned, I think of the biography, I started out as an actor. And now when I speak, or, you know, as a professor in my classroom or here at the Huntington Library, you know, people say, oh, you could tell you were an actor the way you speak or whatever it is. But recently I've been having thoughts with some friends about it. It's more like I grew up as a girl in a working class family, and there weren't a lot of options. My parents, I'm sure, intended me to be a teacher or a nurse for a few years, but they probably thought I would live my life as a married woman with lots of children, or a nun. That was the other option. And so I was always very smart and articulate and fast on my feet. And I think I actually became an actor because that was one of the options for a smart, quick, ambitious, restless girl. And I think that if I had grown up in another family, if I had grown up in another culture, or if I was a boy, I might have ended up in law school. But the way I got to where I am was through acting and being an artist. And that got me out of my sort of small town milieu. It allowed me to sort of jump class in a way. And I did that very happily for about 15 years. But then when I was 30, I thought, you know, I would really love an education because I hadn't had it. And again, college was never in the cards for me. I had had some community college. I'd gone to drama school. But I thought, gosh, I'd love to go to college. But I was 30 and an actor, and certainly not from a family. They couldn't pay for college when I was 18. They couldn't do it when I was 30. But I decided to test the power of asking. So I went to Mount Holyoke College, which I only knew about Hope because I had played characters that had gone to Mount Holyoke College, including Emily Dickinson. And I said, I'm a 30-year-old woman with no money. Can I go to college? And they said, yes, you can. As it turns out, a lot of women's colleges back east have programs for what they call women of non-traditional age, which kind of means older than 23, because they acknowledge that college is often harder for girls and women because of our cultural positions. Some families will have money for one person to go to college. It's the boy. So they have programs. Well, it turned out, Hope, I had found this wonderful program called the Frances Perkins Program. So I went to college at 31, and I lived in the dorms, and I had some little college credits, so I was a junior. And that's where I met my great teachers. I met Joseph Ellis, the famous historian, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, and John McFarriger. And they saw my gifts, and they said to me, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be like you. I want to be a historian and be a professor. They said, well, you're going to have to go to Yale. And Hope, where I come from, people don't look at you and say you're going to have to go to Yale. But they believed in me so much that I just had to. So I went to Yale, and I got my PhD, and I began my work, and again, was sort of a professor, rose to the professorate for about 15 years, assistant, associate. I wrote my books. I became a full professor. I was honored with a UC presidential chair, which is a system-wide honor. And I was set, ready to go, ready to sort of follow that model that men really have set for us of just finishing out one's career. But I decided in my mid-50s that I probably had one more moment of change left. And so I decided that I wanted to move into the world of museums and nonprofits. And how I sort of think about it is I thought that I could bring something to other conversations. As a professor, you talk with your students, but mostly at them, really, and your colleagues and maybe other historians sometimes. But I thought I could have a conversation with a staff, with curators, with a community of supporters, And finally, a conversation with the American public, especially around issues of women, gender, and race. As a member of the Academy, I was aware that these are not insoluble things that you can't talk about, but sometimes, sort of in the public discourse, we treat these issues as like, well, you know, what are you going to do? Sexism, racism, what are you going to do? And I thought I could be a bridge in that world. And so I was very lucky, after about 4 months after I made that decision, this wonderful job here at as Director of Education at the Huntington opened up. And so while I still am technically, I am indeed a professor at UC Riverside, I am really happily ensconced at the Huntington, overseeing programs that I hope are going to be making a difference in the public school system.
Sounds fascinating. So what's on the horizon for you? I know you have one more book that we didn't really talk about Dolly Madison.
Yeah, I still so one of the things I found out, that Dolly and I are bound for life. When you become the biographer of somebody who doesn't have a real biography, a scholarly biography, you become the guardian of her legacy. So practically all the writing that I've done since the book came out have been articles and essays about Dolly Madison. And the book in 2012, actually two books came out. One was called Dolly Madison and the Problem of Unity. And that's really, it's really geared for college students, but it's also kind of a quick and dirty Dolly Madison book. That's Westview Press. But also The Queen of America, which was a transcription and essays around Dolly Madison's first biography, which was written by her niece. So I'm not saying I'm done with research and writing. I've been managing to do it. But yes, right now I'm very intrigued by a new kind of research question, if you will, which is what is the role that a nonprofit like the Huntington can play in a school system and in community organizations? And if they can do something that is real and measurable good, is that a model for other nonprofit institutions? So if approaching being a director of education like a research question, I'm very intrigued by that research question.
It's fascinating. So before we let you go, can you name three things that parents and anybody else can talk about at dinner tonight that will provide additional insights into the life of the amazing Dolly Madison?
Well, it depends on what kind of dinner it is, doesn't it? But if it has children to it, I could tell you three things about Dolly Madison I think are important. She did shape the role of the First Lady as we know it. Things like her relationship as caretaker of the White House, presiding over the social life of the Capitol, all of these things got started under Dolly Madison. Even the role of her as a charismatic figure, that is a kind of larger-than-life figure that dispenses messages of psychological and emotional importance, that started with Dolly. And that turned out to be a crucial function of the First Lady. So in addition to everything else, for some First Ladies who have the taste for it, they can become this kind of larger-than-life figure for their husband's administration. Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy is a perfect example of that. Dolly Madison, it's not every First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt. But our most beloved ones, Betty Ford, had that capacity. So that's an important contribution she made. Looking at how Dolly's political career worked, whether the book or the movie or whatever, you also understand how politics works. And I think that's a really important thing to understand, that for politics to really work, you need the official sphere. And that was James Madison's milieu, right? So that's Congress, and that's minutes of meetings, and now press releases. It's all the official stuff. But when you look at Dolly Madison, you understand that what's really important as well is the unofficial sphere, and think of it as a party, where people can get together, men, women. They get together with families, they talk, they propose, they negotiate, they compromise, all out of the glare of the unofficial spotlight. And understand that's an important place where political work gets done. And in fact, and I'm not the first to say this, part of the problem we have in Washington, D.C. now is that unofficial sphere is very modest or non-existent. But in Dolly, if you look at, so the reason we study women's history is because it tells us things we wouldn't know. And if you just looked at what men were doing in this early period, you would not understand how things got done. But if you look at what the women are doing, including Dolly Madison, you get the fuller picture. And finally, the thing I would say is her greatest historical gift is a model of politics. Her model of politicking was counter to her milieu. So in the early Republic, that's this period we're talking about, politics was very male and very violent. And so this is an era where congressmen and senators are beating each other up and caning each other and challenging each other to duels about politics. And not just in the streets, but actually on the floors of Congress. Dolly presents a different model. It didn't prevail then, but it gives us hope for the future. And it was one that said, let's work together. She understood bipartisanship the way no man in the culture understood it. They didn't even have a word for it, but she understood it. She understood on some level you had to bring people in the room. They had to stop fighting. They had to see each other as humans, and that was going to be the salvation of the system. So it's about building bridges instead of bunkers, making connections, making networks, and not going to the confrontation place. That is her legacy to us. Now, as I said, it did not prevail. It didn't stop the War of 1812. But when we think, oh, my goodness, you know, politics has always been violent. It's always been nasty. It's always been us versus them. It's always been you're evil, I'm not evil. I want you to know that if you look at Dolly Madison, you understand that that's not always been the case, that there has been a lot of work often done by women along a very different track. And as we move forward as Americans, we might look to that model and think that there is something for us. Wow. So if it was a more grown-up dinner party, I would say you could bring up those three things. But especially when you mention the kids, I'll say this. I would tell the story of Dolly Madison, and then I would encourage the children to tell the stories of women, to read books, to listen to their grandmothers, to listen to their aunts and their moms, and begin to incorporate the idea that women's stories have something important to tell us.
Oh, that is just fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Catherine.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. You're very kind to be interested in my work.
Oh, I very much am, and Dolly Madison, and all the truly amazing women that you are coming into contact with. So we will loop back around with you many times and hopefully expand our reach into the history and the academic world. We are here today with Dr. Catherine Algor, a professor of history at the University of California, a Yale PhD, who is the director of education at the Huntington Library Art Collection and Botanical Gardens. We were talking today about her book, Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation, and all things Dolly Madison. That's it today for the Truly Amazing Women Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. We look forward to talking to you soon. That's it for today's episode of the Truly Amazing Women Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. If you're a truly amazing woman or know someone who is, don't hesitate to contact us. Simply log on to www.trulyamazingwomen.com and fill out the proposal form. We've profiled more than 250 women on the site who fit the bill of being truly amazing, and we look forward to honoring more. Who will be our next truly amazing woman? Tune in next week for a new episode on www.incandescentradio.com. Here's to your incredible, indelible success.